So this is some work I've been doing recently with Abhishekar and Miguel Campiglia, who's another rabbi's students, trying to look at a connection between really loop quantum gravity and spin foams, but through the eyes of loop quantum cosmology. The introduction and kind of the outline of the talk is we're exactly looking at that this major open question of what is this connection between two very similar looking theories. They share a lot of components, being loop quantum gravity, our canonical theory, and spin foams. And so we know that a rigorous connection between these two will likely resolve a lot of problems of both. The one interest I have in this is to basically come up with a kind of a correct regularization of the scalar constraint, loop quantum gravity. We know that spin foams have a much better contact to the semi-classical theory, and so it's a great way to test anything we do in LQG if we have a connection back and forth. So the idea is to use an exactly soluble model of loop quantum cosmology to probe this connection. So in this case, we can do everything very precisely and really check everything. And so what we're going to do is construct an expansion of loop quantum cosmology, in this case, a sum over histories expansion, that will mimic the vertex expansion of spin foam models. And then using this expansion, we can gain insight into a number of open questions of spin foams and the connection between the two theories. And I'll talk about a couple of them, being the continuum limit of spin foams and the physical meaning of the group field theory coupling constant. And there's a bunch of others, but I don't want to cram too much into the one-to-one talk. Yeah, so the outline will be mainly to first just talk a bit about this connection between LQG and spin foams as it is now, and then go through this construction of this LQC expansion, and then talk about some of the features, some of the things that we actually learned from this. So in going from loop quantum gravity to spin foams, the idea would be to really derive the spin foam models from this group average inner product. So here we have a physical state generated from one kinematic spin network and another physical state generated from some other kinematic spin network. And this here is really the physical inner product between these two. So the idea is that spin foam should give us, it basically should define the dynamics of quantum gravity, which is exactly defined by our physical Hilbert space, in this case by the physical inner product. And this can be given either by, say, group averaging with some master constraint, or as just, some group averaging with just the normal scalar constraint with integrals over, say, all lapses here. And one of the original motivations for spin foams came from a construction by Reisenberger and Rivelli, exactly starting off an expansion of this amplitude appearing in the definition of the physical inner product. Basically, by expanding out this exponential, you can recognize this amplitude as sum over histories of spin networks. So this is, it gives one picture of spin foams being like a sum over histories of spin networks. Unfortunately, the expansion they have is really divergent term by term, exactly due to the need to take this integral over the lapse, basically to actually carry out the group averaging. So the problem really lies in this expression alone one can expand and see as kind of a path integral, much like spin foams, but the integral over our lapse or our group averaging often causes divergences. And we know that for 2 plus 1 gravity, there is a rigorous construction, which is actually carried out in a different manner. In that case, we first group average, so first carry out this integral, because the constraint is simple enough to actually do the group averaging, and then expand the result as a spin foam. In that case, there's much more rigorous connection, and we know that the connection between the canonical theory and spin foams. But this is very difficult to generalize to more general models. It involves a much deeper knowledge of the spectrum of whatever constraint you have. So really, this seems like it's a very non-trivial problem, especially because group averaging essentially gives us what distribution. So if I take this integral d alpha or with exponential, I get like a delta function of the Masch constraint. And kind of intuitively, the idea of perturbably computing a distribution just seems like a crazy idea. It's just not going to work. So you can see why problems would arise. So coming from the other side, coming from spin foams, say down loop quantum gravity, it seems like we're really going to have to work on both ends really to make contact. Because the goal here is to find a spin foam model that shares as many features of Lucan gravity as possible. You know, along these lines, there have been a lot of recent advances, like, you know, the inclusion of the emergency parameter, making better contact to the classical theory that we started off with in LQG. And then, you know, connection to the kinematics of LQG, having our states based on, the labels being SU2 rather than SO31 and SL2C. And further, having at least in the EPRL model, the boundary states are actually being the SU2 spin networks. So it's a much stronger connection to Lucan gravity. And then the recent extension of the EPRL vertex to arbitrary graphs, not just those restricted to four vertices, to four edges for each node. That was the KKL extension, which is much easier than saying the actual name. So it's Kaminsky, Kieślowski, and Lewandowski. But there's still some very important questions in order to kind of have the spin foams in a form that we can build up to. One being the continuum limit of spin foams, because we know that these are defined on a fixed triangulation, but loop quantum gravity is a theory of continuum gravity. So the question is, what exactly defines this continuum limit of spin foams? Would it be a refinement of one triangulation, a sum over all possible triangulations, or some other structure? But this idea of, you know, what are we getting here is really, it's important for building up from quantum gravity. It's the exact structures we're looking for. So this works in two ways. One, to tell us what we're looking for from quantum gravity, but also quantum gravity may inform spin foams exactly what the notion of this limit is. And further, kind of based on this idea, is, you know, what do we have if we take a theory with, say, only one triangulation, say a fixed one, or the sum over just a finite number? Exactly what is that? How much of the full theory of quantum gravity have we left out by doing that? Which may also, the loop quantum gravity may help answer that question. Exactly what do we have by taking only some fixed number of triangulations? You know, in what sense have we solved our constraints? And further, you know, if group field theory kind of gives us a way to define a continuum limit of spin foams, each term basically is one spin foam. In that case, there's this coupling constant that appears, and so in that case, we have to wonder, well, if this is a really a fundamental theory, what is the kind of gravitational, you know, meaning of this coupling constant? You know, what actually is it? So these questions are things that we hope to probe using this LQC spin foam connection. As I said, you know, we're using loop quantum cosmology here as a toy model. So we're studying these issues all through the k equals zero loop quantum cosmology with the massive scalar field. So this is the most heavily studied model. And it's, while it's far from the full theory, it's technically simple, which is nice, but also it's physically interesting. Because this is modeling the cosmology, which is, you know, the very thing we're out measuring now. And also LQC has many of the key features of the full theory. Namely, you know, there's the new representation, you know, its constrained system, and it shares many of the conceptual difficulties, being like a problem of dynamics, a problem of time. And also the really nice thing is this model is exactly soluble, as you've seen in the Ashkar-Krejci Singh paper. So it lets us compute everything that we're doing really exactly, so we can compare any expansion to the exact results. And so that was really one of the main reasons for tackling this model. So as I said, you know, so this is all exactly solvable. So the calculations here are not formal. Really, everything we do comes down to only one assumption. So it's quite nice. So what we're looking at is a lot of the details of LQC really aren't important here. But we're looking at is the transition amplitude between, what kind of transition amplitude between two basis vectors labeled by a volume and a scalar field phi, which are in our kinematical Hilbert space. And in this sense, these are like the analogs of the spin networks used to define the boundary of a spin foam. And so here they satisfy a very simple inner product. The volumes new here just have a discrete inner product, so a Kronecker delta, and phis are just normal continuous variables. But this discrete structure is very important for the results of the rest of the talk. So this transition amplitude here will really be given by the group average inner product or the physical inner product between the physical states, these two, which are generated from some basis vectors in our kinematical space. And so here again, this is given by group averaging. So we have inside here we have our kinematic inner product, and we have this exponential constraint, and this factor is just inserted just to make life easier for the mathematics. But there's an ambiguity in defining how this is set up. So this is just find and insert. And lost track of time. So here, this constraint here is just, it's a fairly simple. One part is just p phi squared, a normal, minus d squared, d phi squared. And theta here is a difference operator acting on the volumes. So one part just acts to shift volume forward by amount, one part keeps volume the same, and one part shifts the volume back. Yep? So here the volumes can take all real values, and actually all positive and negative, but it's just coming from the orientation factor. And there's a discrete measure on those. And actually the dynamics or this theta will pick out just a lattice. So it picks out those volumes that are separated by four times some length. So basically 4L naught being some Planck length related size.
The volume is positive, but mu can assume negative.
Right.
The volume is
positive. Yeah. The volume is absolute value of mu with some other constants put in there. But so in this case, so here, we can have these volumes really being any real number, but it comes down to actually computing this physical inner product. Since the dynamics picks out a lattice separated by 4L naught, by four times this Planck length, or like a Planck volume roughly, it really restricts down just a discrete set of volumes. Now we're actually computing things. And so this strategy here is really to obtain expansion of just this amplitude under the integral first, basically a sum over Hilbert's expansion, such that we can do this integral, we can do the group averaging term by term. That way we'll have actually a well-defined expansion. So the p phi is here. Basically, when doing the group averaging, the physical state we could see here as being this kind of projector or extractor, this integral d alpha e di alpha c acting on this final state. And so this together forms basically like a dual state, right? And there's kind of you have to define how this acts on your kinematic states. And you have this ambiguity in exactly how you define that action. So it could be just this acting on just the dual state, acting on just the kinematic state, or we can insert this parameter. And then the two theories would be they're unitary equivalent, whether we have this factor or not. It's just having this in there makes my life much easier for doing all the calculations and also seeing physical results out in the main theory. So.
It would be that you calculate not this scalar product, but the correlation function of p phi.
This is really the definition of this physical inner product. So it's really not, because this is, so doing it this way is unitary equivalent to not having this in there. It's just life is much simpler having that.
But suppose I do have a calculated correlation function of mm-hmm. Then I would insert it on the left-hand side.
Right.
Propagate on the right-hand
side. Well, then we'd have a p phi squared here.
You're saying this will be unitarily equivalent to calculating with just one p phi?
Yeah, I mean,
again, this is unitarily equivalent.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that the some of these things I haven't looked at for a while, but part of it is also the operators for physical observables also are different whether you're looking at this with the p phi here without. So since like for volume, the volume operator is much more complicated if if this is not there, but it's not, you know, it's fairly simple with this factor in there. I guess maybe we can talk about it later.
What's kind of interpretation for phi?
For phi? Well, right now, phi is just a scalar field. So it's just some scalar field. And it can be viewed as a time, as we often do in LQC, if you want to deparameterize the theory. But if looking at this in terms of like a group averaging type approach, right now it's part of our kinematical Hilbert space. It's just a mass, just our matter phi. Yeah. So I have to go back and check, but from what I recall, that these they are equivalent, but it may not be trivial to see exactly why. Because this is actually the kind of the definition used for LQC, and often you can either have this as p phi here or as a factor of the square root of the theta operator, and you get the same thing. But yeah, but this is really the definition used in LQC.
Oh, because of the constraint, right?
Or
because
the constraint is. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, we can always come back to this, and I can. So we can just take this as the definition of our physical inner product, and it doesn't pay too much of importance. But we begin with expanding this amplitude. I think I remember what it is. Is you can just absorb that factor into the definition of your states, and that's what happens. You absorb that factor of p phi into how you define your states, and so that is really the difference. I have to go back and look at some of the details. So we begin with this amplitude. Just without our integral over alpha, without our group averaging integral, and we'll closely follow just standard Feynman construction to try to get a path integral of this. In this case, this nicely factors into one part for the gravitational and one part for the scalar field. So the gravitational part is here, and what we can do is view this alpha theta as being like our evolution operator with just some unit time. And so divide this up into n copies of itself and insert complete bases between all of these. So doing this is a standard path integral construction. So doing this now is a sum over these histories and volume of the product of all these amplitudes. And so the idea is, as with the normal construction, is to evaluate all these terms in the limit that as n goes to infinity. And normally this would give us something of the form e to the I action. You'd expect, but actually, due to the discreteness of these volume states, in the limit we don't get EDI action. We don't get a normal path integral.
Here you have delta parameter, which is one.
Yeah, the time. Yeah, it's just we can just have some parameter time that runs from 0 to 1, basically.
Which is the polynomial parameter.
It's just a sum. Number. It's not really, you know, because here this would be kind of generating like kind of a gauge, the gauge evolution in a sense. So, is there a question? No, I thought I saw one. So initially just for the gravitational part, because the scalar field part is essentially, it's kind of trivial here. You can just evaluate it exactly. I mean, you could similarly just expand the scalar field part as well as a path integral, but it would just be a normal traditional path integral for scalar field part. But in this case, you just insert a complete basis in p phi, and it's evaluated very simply, just because it splits so nicely into the scalar field part and gravity.
Question?
Yes, yeah, because one depends only on the scalar field, and one is purely gravitational. Yeah. So in that sense, this is part of what makes it exactly soluble. And it's also part of what makes it the fact that we can also deparameterize the theory and really view you know, phi is a time. Right. Yeah, so the so what happens is typically we take this limit and goes to infinity, and we could write, you know, this the amplitude for each path would be of the form e to the I action for some this our classical action. But actually due to the discreteness of these states, this doesn't happen. And this limit as epsilon goes to zero or n goes to infinity, where epsilon here is just one over n, it's just it's non-trivial. Basically, you can see these here is just these terms expanded out to first order in epsilon. So what you could do in this large n limit, and if these volumes are the same, this is fine. This is like, you know, one minus I epsilon times some number. The volumes are different though. Let's say here that this would be zero minus some factor that's proportional to epsilon. So the overall amplitude ends up being proportional to epsilon, epsilon squared, epsilon cubed. So in some limit, each single path just has no contribution. So we can't just trivially kind of push this limit under the sum. It has to be taken a bit more carefully. And so the main idea to solve kind of this question, to have a spin foam-like expansion, and to be able to carry out the group averaging term by term, is to basically just rearrange our sum over paths. So we take a finite n, so a finite history, going from some initial volume up to some final volume with basically n minus one volumes in between. And we just rearrange the sum of those paths. So we say, all right, well, I have a sum from m equals zero to n being how many times our path actually changes. So it could be all the volumes could be the exact same. I could have the same volumes for the first five, and then it could change and be a different volume from then on. We have a sum over what volumes we actually took, along that path. And then exactly, basically, how many volumes took that same value. So I could probably just sketch it out. But the key is that, you know, we have a sum over histories, starting with our initial volume to our final volume, with like n volumes in between, and I have the first case m equals zero where those volumes are all the exact same. I have the m equals one where I have, let's say, some number of the volumes are the same, and then I have the changes and I have the rest of the volumes all the same as well. I'm doing purple. Yeah. So say it at the simplest case where I have one transition, my paths start off at some volume initial, go to some volume final, and along the way we have, say, volume 1, volume 2, volume 3, and there's some number of these which is given by this n1 of how many volumes share the same value, and then we have how many volumes have the second value. And so here these are all taking some value I just called like probably, you know, V initial here, and these all take some value, some V1 or V final. But the idea is just to group paths according to the paths that are constant almost everywhere, changing value only m times. And so what we'll find is, and seeing this as a spin foam-like structure, this m corresponds to like a sum over triangulations, and these here correspond to like a sum over labels of triangulation, being a sum over. So here we have, this is m equals 1 for having only one change of volume, and we'll have a sum over what volumes are actually taken by these two. And we'll see more of the structures as we go along. And as I said, this is just a sum over how many volumes along the way take these values. Is this somewhat clear?
Do you have an explicit example
of... this system itself is the explicit example, I guess. But yes, I don't quite have like nice pictures and stuff drawn up because it's all up here really. If it changes and come back to the same value, that would be included in say the m equals, yes, it is ordered. That's right. So. Yeah, m equals 2 if it changes twice to go up and back down. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so those patterns like that and have an important contribution to the overall amplitude, the ones that kind of oscillate back and forth between.
So n is just the number.
Yeah, n is the number of times it changes, right? So n equals 0 is the trivial. If your initial state is the same as the final state, it's all just flat. Nothing happens. But this one's kind of dense, but a lot of it isn't so important. But the main idea is that this together, if we fix an M, fix the volumes that are actually taken along that path as we go through all these jumps, we can add up all those amplitudes for every one of these paths, no matter how long we spent in each volume. And together, all of these, we can take the limit as our n goes to infinity, or as epsilon goes to zero. So in that case, we can take this continuum limit. So it's here that, you know, by rearranging the sum, we can take this limit n goes to infinity. So these sums are still just here, and this limit was taken over the sum of all those the n's or how long we spent in each volume. And so this here, I've combined in just this scalar field part. But this amplitude here is given by this expression, which is somewhat complicated, but the important facts is the sum over how long we spent in each volume just goes over to integrals of exactly how long we spent in each volume. So if I have, let's say, the m equals 2, if I say m equals 2 here, we would have time 0, tau 1, tau 2, and this would end at 1. And so we would fix, we'd fix some volumes here, so some volume specified for these three bits, and then we'd have integrals over exactly where in time did these changes happen. And then there's an amplitude here associated to each part of this. So we have an amplitude which is like an exponential associated to all those parts of the volume's constant, an amplitude associated to an amplitude for each part where the volume changes. And the important element that actually lets us do the overall group averaging later is the fact that these are exponentials, and it's not just purely polynomial in this parameter alpha. So as I said here, I mean, this is only an expansion of just this. But in order to get the actual physical inner product, we now have to integrate this over alpha, and hopefully do it for every term of this sum separately in order to have a well-defined expansion. And so, as I said here, we really have a well-defined expansion if we can do this integral for every term separately. Because otherwise, we'll have to resum the whole series first and then do the integral, which is kind of useless because we want to do things perturbatively. Be able to get out just only a few terms. So our one assumption is that this integral over alpha, or the integral over basically like our lapse, really commutes with the sum over m, the sum over the number of times this path changes volumes. So it's just pushing this through these sums over m and the sums over the volumes actually taken along the path. And somewhat surprisingly, this actually converges. So If we push this through, the integral of the amplitude over here will converge for every choice of m and these volumes. So it's just here saying that this result here will actually converge to a number for all of these, which is very important because we have because exactly in spin foams we don't have some integral over the constraints still surviving. We just have sums over the labels. So in some sense, we have to carry the constraint for every term that's expansion separately. So here, the nu's will be allowed to be negative, but basically what they can be is picked out really by the initial and final values. So if you start off with both finals positive, every one in between. So the sum can range over all volumes, but for many, many choices, you just get zero transition. Because this theta operator, which is in our constraint, only connects like nearby volumes. It can only get you from this one volume to itself, or one volume one step ahead, or one step back. there's always a finite number of terms, right? And so if you start off in the positive sector, you actually can't get to the negative news. So if we had initial being negative, final positive, this would just be a zero amplitude.
So you can't pass from one orientation, go to zero, and then choose switch to orientation. That's not possible.
Right, it's not possible. And it's exactly because in this k equals zero loop quantum cosmology, the zero volume state is decoupled from the rest of the Hilbert space. So that was the first reason why they thought that we had this singularity resolution in that case, because you can see that the zero volume just wasn't part of the dynamics, it just decoupled. And so this is exactly why here we can't change that different orientation, because we can't go across that zero. It's nice here that, yeah, so for a fixed m, there's just a finite number of these terms. Yes?
So two questions on how you do. So what is the P5 delta 5 term from?
Oh, so this is just coming from... we would have had...
Well, the P5 squared is part of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, part of the constraint.
So what's the other term?
But we would have had, say, 5 final, e to the I alpha, P5 squared, phi initial. So this is just, it's coming from inserting a complete basis in the conjugate momenta in here.
Just once.
So we'd have, P5, this way, P5 and P5, and then integral, dP5. And then, so here, this one of these gives us an e to the I p phi, the other gives us an e to the minus I p phi final order.
Okay, just why does it converge? I mean, the integral p phi d p phi is Gaussian.
Right.
It's really Gaussian, but once you do that Gaussian, the dependence on alpha looks funny. It's like increasing that with minus 1 over alpha.
So
how do you manage to do times an alpha over alpha dependence? How do you manage to do that?
So it's actually, it's since this... So you can do it that way, and it's a bit sticky and very hard to work through. But the way it's much easier to evaluate it is that this depends on alpha mostly as exponentials, or at least as a polynomial alpha times exponential. So it'd be like alpha e to the I alpha or e to the I alpha. So if you integrate over alpha here, you get this together with the exponentials here will give like distributions. So like delta p phi, delta p phi squared minus something or higher distributions, like derivatives of delta functions. And then since those are now all sitting under this integral, they all make sense, and we can handle all those distributions. The other way, doing the integral p alpha first, I think, was much more complicated, and it's kind of more rigorous, possibly, but it's...
And do you have a closed form for the amplitude?
Yeah, we have a closed form for this, and then for the whole expression. So if you want to... That's on I just tacked it on at the very end, if you wanted to see it.
No, but this is the only step that couples the two sectors of the scalar field and the gravitational.
Right. So it's really just coming from, well, it's exactly what would happen in the even just the classical theory. It's really the constraint that's directly coupling the two sectors.
Right.
So since we can do this integral, basically what we end up with is our physical inner product given by just a sum over m being how many times our volume changed, a sum of what volumes it actually were with some amplitude. And so here it's just kind of packaged that as a sum over m of an amplitude for every, what I'll call something like a triangulation. So in a sense, each term m, we can just say, let's erase this the easy way, so we have some interval from 0 to 1. Actually, even the time now doesn't really matter too much. But for every m, it behaves kind of like a line with m marked points or m vertices. So we have, say, m. In this case, m is just 5. And so each m kind of corresponds to our triangulation here of exactly... how many volumes do we have, or how many times does our volume change? And then our labels correspond to just labeling each of these constant pieces with some volume. So V3, V4, and some V final. So basically, we really view this is really our dual triangulation, because what we really have is, say, the dual to this would be some So basically our unit cell or some chunk of space here, some volume here. So these are just some little three spaces with volume. But we see that each term seems to correspond to a spin foam amplitude on a fixed triangulation. So we have a fixed number of vertices and the sum over all the possible volumes you could have along that history. And then the full group average inner product is really obtained by summing over all such triangulations. So all such, you know, all such triangulations of having m vertices along this line. In this case, they're very simple. It's just it's just a line with marked points. But we would see it's not coming from a refinement. It's just coming from a sum over all such possible triangulations. But so this is really kind of it's like a concrete realization of the expectation that spin foams. If to get the full continuum will be a sum over all triangulations, not necessarily a refinement of one. Of course, this is just an example, but this is it's very interesting to see that that's the exact structure arising. It's a sum over all our triangulations.
So
yes?
This has the same structure as a 1 plus 1 dimensional causal dynamical triangulation. It's a sum over where n is the number of triangles at each time step.
Mm-hmm. Depended on so if depended on just phi, then you could do the same. You could just have a path that go with only the scalar field. If the potential term depends on like the what? Thank you. Forgot about that when I came in. But if the potential depends on say both if it mixes gravity and the scalar field, then we'll have basically a kind of a path integral for the scalar field during in each of these chunks. Because there the volume is constant, so we can. Is there nowhere to plug it in? Very nice. Thank you. Yeah. So I mean, the surprising thing was it was exactly. This isn't say at some discrete level. It's really in the limit of our continuum for our path integral. This structure arises, which is very surprising. And so that's kind of the structure we have, and there's an alternative way to reach this, which kind of makes better contact with like group field theory or just normal quantum mechanics, which is to take our constraint and just formally split it up into a free part, being this p phi squared minus the diagonal portion of our theta operator, and then just split off this off diagonal part with some coupling constant lambda. And we can just use kind of normal textbook interaction picture, just the things that we do in Peskin and Schroeder, say, to expand, to basically do the same expansion and say our physical inner product expressed by this expansion. Now the only difference is we have this coupling constant shoved in here. So they're equivalent if we just go back to lambda equal 1. So there's really two approaches to get here. One being this idea of how do we kind of combine our sums over paths in kind of clever ways such that this limit makes sense, which that is, I think there's more ways to do that than there are ways to split the constraint, or it's just to really split the constraint off into some diagonal piece and some off diagonal piece, or maybe in some other clever manner to go about this construction. And so now the question comes up, well, in group field theory, you know, like let's suppose it is a more fundamental theory, which would be very interesting if it were. We have to understand what is the meaning of this constant lambda that appears, and since we have group field theory, it's like a quantum field theory. What would it mean as lambda actually flows as it changes? So in this case, we can study in our model at least what lambda would mean if we actually let it be just not one, just some more general number. So first, I mean, just to see kind of how lambda behaves here, how the coupling behaves, we can check and see that this physical inner product is a solution to our constraint. That should be true. It's if we view this as a function of these two final, volume final and phi final, basically this is a, what this is it's like our physical state generated from this do initial, phi initial, expanded in terms of this, in terms of this basis. So this should definitely satisfy the constraint if we're acting on these two final values. So it's an important consistency check to make sure that all everything we did is completely valid. And it's instructive here to actually keep these constants, so keep lambda in the sum and lambda in the theta operator. And we can see that the vertex expansion we have, it does solve the constraint order by order in lambda. So if we take just some number of terms up to say n star or n maximum and act on the constraint, the result is of order it's of the next higher order in lambda. So this does actually give a perturbative solution to the constraint.
Can I ask a question? First you have a sum over n, right?
Right.
And then you did a perturbative expansion. Wouldn't that, so at first,
two sums.
One from the expanding and exponential,
mm-hmm.
right? So the exact expression is you have a sum over n.
Mm-hmm.
You split it into the free part and then the action part, and you have an e to the I and the action part.
Oh, no. So the,
why do I have only one sum here now?
This here is actually a distinct approach from the previous. So here, this is just... So we just start over. This is kind of distinct from the past section.
What is the distinction between D and K?
D is just the part of the constraint that's diagonal. So it's just...
So it doesn't change the volume.
Right. And since we actually have a discrete basis, diagonal makes sense. You can say what it means to have diagonal.
So again, one can say that the number of Ks is the number of changes in the volume.
Right. Yes, yeah, so that's what happens, is the number of times K shows up is exactly related to the number of times the volume changes. Right. And so here, yeah, we can see that this does actually satisfy the constraint and up to whatever order in lambda you want. So if we had a nice physical meaning for lambda, we'd have a perturbative solution up to whatever order we'd like. And actually, the way it solves it is also quite interesting. I was kind of surprised by it. You can see here that this piece, this d phi squared minus d, you know, this will just act on it and not change lambda. While this term, right, will give us, you know, the lambda plus one. So this is solved if this acting on, say, the mth term plus this acting on the m minus one term is zero. Which you can see here, it's solved, you know, term by term in lambda. So it's saying that the solution to the constraint happens between two very similar triangulations. In this case, between the one with n minus one vertices and n vertices, or n minus one changes in volume and n changes in volume. So it's solved in actually a very simple way. And even simpler than that, this equation is kind of solved, I'd say, like this path by path. So these here are each sums over the volumes taken along this path, or the actual colorings of the triangulation. And so this diagonal piece acting on, in this case, just two paths coming out of this term, the ones with, say, phi initial, nu initial, all the nu minus 2 fixed, and then sum over the two possible values of nu minus 1, this cancels with this off-diagonal piece acting on only one path from this one, where again we have this new initial off the new n minus 2 fixed, and this is acting on only this final value. So the solution I thought would be very complicated to see, but actually turns out to be very, very simple. It's still complicated to prove, but it's solved in a very simple way, meaning that it's just solved, the cancellations happen between not only triangulations that are so close, but also by the labelings of triangulations that are so close. So at fixed order lambda here, we have the cancellations occur between two very similar paths, three, being, so for every path acted on by the off-diagonal piece, there's two acted on by the diagonal part that cancel it. So the intuition I would gather for this is the hope that if we have spin foams, if they do solve the, some scale constraint, you know, we're not quite sure exactly what we should have for scale constraint yet, but likely could be seen by cancellations between very, very similar triangulations. So not having to look at, say, the full sum, but looking at just, say, you know the triangulations that are differ by, say, one vertex, and carrying all the same labels except for maybe at one vertex or a few edges or faces. So it's a much more simpler task than having to check the action constraint on entire spin foam amplitude, or on say the entire spin foam amplitude summed over all triangulations. So it's a possibility of this being actually a fairly simple task. Yes?
Yeah. Does this mean if I want to measure the correlation function of some product of volumes at different times, mm-hmm. it just factors into products of volumes to basically this correlation between volumes at successive times?
Would that be true? I'm not sure. Why would you expect that?
Because it almost looks like the quantum field equation is being satisfied because if it's satisfied in every path, it's like mm-hmm. you've just summed over solution to the classical field.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so this, it's not entirely, I mean, so this, so, what can I say? It's not entirely just completely solved on every solution. It's that the cancellations occur at every solution. But if I act with say, so that's like here. If I cut off at some final point, I still have these higher returns contributing. So it's not that every path solves it. It's that the combination between these two different paths kind of cancel together. But it'd actually be much more interesting, yeah, if every path on its own would just solve it. So also for the triangulations, it's really coming from the interaction between, you know, these two, the simpler one with less vertices and one with more, that cancel together. But actually for the case of, I mean, looking at the current constraints we have for fluid quantum gravity, those are always graph changing. In that case, there'd be no diagonal part. And so maybe that really we should have that every triangulation should solve it independently. Because then there'd be no turn here, just really this. So that's just a vague idea.
So this
we can solve. I mean, so I have the exact amplitude for these, and so I can just act on it with act this on this one, act this with here, and see that this is zero, and so because of this zero for this, and so then the whole constraint is satisfied. So this does supply a solution to the constraint. And it makes sense it should, but it's a very important check to see that all of the steps of changing, especially changing the integral of alpha through the sum, that is a valid step. But it's also very interesting exactly how it solved it. So we have this interesting way that solves it, but we still have to kind of know if lambda itself has a meaning beyond just being just some mathematical parameter, right? So exactly here, really, what is the physical meaning of this? And we notice that there's a very interesting structure. If we consider FRW with a cosmological constant, sorry, some of the words I can't say very well, we can carry out the exact same expansion for this model with a constant, and we find that there's an isomorphism. So if we take the theory that has lambda not equal to 1 in our constraint and a cosmological constant, This can be mapped to a theory with lambda equal 1, and this constant being different, given exactly by this. So we can see that if lambda doesn't equal to 1, basically acts as a shift in the value of that constant. And a much more transparent way to see it is if we say, let's say our physical theory we're starting off with should have lambda equal 1, because that's what the constraint is, and let's say it has no cosmological constant. So this can map to a theory with lambda not equal to 1 and a constant given by this equation here. So here for lambda very small, let's say for lambda close to 0, this is huge. So it's like a Planck size constant. And for lambda approaching 1, this goes to a very, very small constant. So there was the kind of the hope that maybe in some sense, the flow associated to this parameter lambda in GFT could be related to this, you know, I mean, it's kind of a stretch of an idea, but could be related to really the flow of our cosmological constant. That say for very small values of lambda, this acts like a Planck size constant, and for values close to one, this goes to our normal, fairly small but positive value. But this gives us really a physical meaning of this lambda. So a nice way to interpret this expansion. And the other thing that was interesting was not quite as positive is that we actually have two distinct expansions that we can construct, and at least. So here, the one that's easier to find is if we first do the group averaging and then carry out the resulting expression as the same kind of vertex expansion, it looks very different term by term, very, very different term by term. But the two will converge to the same result. So you know, we have this observation that you know, in attempting to construct a spin-pole model from the quantum gravity, we could arrive at very, very many different types of expansions. Which is both good and bad. I mean, on one side, it means it may be hard to actually match up the two theories. On the other side, having more expansions never hurts. So each one may have a distinct physical use, a distinct regime where it's useful. So it could be both good and bad. And then actually, there's this a number of others depending on exactly how one wants to rearrange the paths in your sum. There's a number of other ways of grouping them. They're kind of interesting. And one final idea, it's just a very recent idea that I've been toying with, but it's fun to mention some of these things sometimes, is the idea that the physical inner product, we can also write it as like a phase-based path integral for the quantum cosmology. And further, for every the amplitude for every triangulation, we can also write down as a path integral. In some form. So this is much like with spin foams, where we really have a path integral defined for the amplitude for every triangulation, not quite for the whole thing. And so in this case, this integral, I just left off the matter part. But the integral over volume here ranges over these like step functions of volume. So it takes value v1 over some time, or v initial over some time, v1 over some time, etc. And so the integral just runs over the times at which these occur, and then the values of the volumes. And then the integral over B just runs over the values of B at these vertices. And further, we can see that we have full path integral for LQC. We can decompose this integral over volumes into a sum of these integrals over each of these integrals over step functions. And in doing so, you can actually reduce this to a sum over exactly these amplitudes. And the idea would be is basically if could we reverse this for spin foams. In spin foam models, what we have exactly is this. We have an amplitude for each triangulation. And we could we somehow see that what we have is really a sum over, we have a sum over these triangulations, which gives a sum over integrals over these different basically piecewise constant geometries. And from there, just see, observe that we really do have some continuum path integral, which you know basically what we've done is start off with a continuum integral, say for BF, and said, well, the geometries we really have will be piecewise constant. Let's break up that integral into a bunch of integrals over all the different ways of having piecewise constant paths, integrate that out, and find a sum over triangulations with amplitudes for each triangulation. This is kind of just an idea I just threw in there. It's a very, very recent thought. But maybe it'll spur some other ideas along that direction. And so just to conclude, about around time, so what we found is a spin foam like expansion of LQC, which is non-trivial that really exists, because all these integrals work out, with only one main assumption, which given by a sum over M, which is like our sum over triangulations, how many times the volume changes along the way, with some sum over labelings or what volumes actually took and an amplitude for each one of those. And this gives us some insight into both the connection between loop quantum gravity and spin foams, kind of how construction could be done from loop quantum gravity. So some of the techniques that we have to have. And and also into kind of questions of both LQG and spin pumps on their own. So first, it indicates that the continuum limit could be given by really some overall triangulation, just reinforcing that idea for spin foams. That the group field theory parameter may really have a physical interpretation. In this case, it gains interpretation of being like the cosmological constant. And finally, there are multiple expansions that look very different, which both is very good because we have many ways of doing physics, and a bit of a challenge because we have to be very careful working in both directions to see that our expansions in the spin foam side and Lucan gravity side will actually match up. Then we'll have just like one unified theory. And so that's it. Thank you all.
So questions?
Yeah.
It's more like common. So A, your A is like vertex number in Euclid's.
So in a sense, well, this is like a combination of like all the vertex amplitudes. Yeah.
And I think I would add one more conclusion to your list of conclusions. I think your derivation shows a fact which is not always appreciated, that whereas in Rovelli-Reisenberger derivation of amplitudes, the vertex amplitude appears as matrix element of the Hamiltonian operator, your derivation shows that it's actually a matrix element of the evolution operator. Well,
right.
Integrated maybe, but so. I think that this is, well, a big difference, and your derivation indicates in concrete direction.
Yeah, I mean, so there's different ways to view it. One, you could view it as being, you know, what shows up in the amplitude is really it's the matrix elements of this theta, this element of the constraint. But also, yeah, depending on how you view it, it can also be the matrix elements of the. It depends on exactly in what, because it's a very simple model. You can read it kind of different ways, and what you want to get out of it. So, because it's exactly how you generalize. There's many ways to generalize beyond this. So the group field theory. We've been trying, started thinking about exactly what we haven't actually constructed like a group field theory that reduces this. I mean the idea is to be that it would be like. Probably that's like a U1, very fairly simple group, and have very simple interactions. But we've always been interested in actually just constructing one that does produce this expansion. So here it was just this was really this kind of a more group field theory like idea of just you know I mean it's more just going back to like a normal quantum field theory or normal perturbation theory. Yeah.
I mean, let's say, so what you're doing is very interesting, but there's something misleading when you say that this lambda is analogous to the next step would be to take the same kind of model, but to have an Hamiltonian that change, for instance, the number, not only the volume labor on functions, but the number of functions.
Right.
Because lambda is not really associated to the propagation that keeps this number fixed. So, I mean, the true analogy is that you have a discrete structure, this point, let's say, you know, carries the color, but also you're allowing the volume to change the number of functions.
Right,
functions.
So.
Not only changing the volume of each functions.
Yeah, because
then. That might be an interesting.
Yeah, that's what we've been thinking. Because since what happens at LQC is the whole data of a spin network is collapsed down to just that one parameter. So you can't really see that you're adding new vertices and things. I think what would be interesting is to take, let's say, like 2 plus 1, where we know a lot about it, and try to carry a similar expansion there. Because that's where you could see, you know, things being added, you know, vertices being added and taken away.
Question?
Yeah.
There are versions of Lucan cosmology which are not exactly solvable, which have more dynamics in them, isotropies and continuance.
Right.
Is there anything useful you could get out of representing those in the language as a path and growth?
Yeah, I mean, so the the things that we'd like is you know, one is if you have a perturbative solution to the physical inner product, basically. So if you, I mean, you can, so we actually start looking at Bianchi 1, say, where we don't know much about Bianchi 1. And so at least at the simplest stage, one could analyze a bit about, you know, the physical Hilbert space by being able to actually compute things like this physical inner product. And so we haven't looked a lot at actually like what observables say you could approximate things like that, but the fact that we could at least get approximate solutions for these more complex models. And because another thing that's shown up, which I haven't quite proven exactly why, is that this expansion also is very well behaved for small values of change in phi. And so as you add more terms, it converges to larger and larger values delta phi. So it's very good at looking at kind of at small changes, which could be good for actually very near like the big bounce. So looking at possibly just.
But is this because you don't have any interactions with dynamics?
Yeah. So this is partially because because the scalar field actually makes a nice clock and it's fairly trivial. But basically all the tools we have here are easily extended to any theory with a discrete basis, so like Bianchi 1 or any cosmologies or spin networks, and even the matter may not even be necessary. It just makes life much more technically simple.
Okay, and then maybe the last question. So it's not a surprise that if you start by exponentiating the constraints and call that your path integral, mm-hmm. you end up, quote, summing over the triangulations. I mean, that's been obvious mm-hmm. the way things set up. So if somebody comes and says, I have a different form of the path integral which doesn't have a sum over triangulation, mm-hmm. but has an embossing sort of limit, does the fact that you don't need to sum to get a solution to the Hamiltonian constraint to support the idea that there might be a quantum theory defined without some of the triangulations?
Without some of the triangulations. So here, you know, we have to, in order to solve the Hamiltonian constraint exactly, we have to sum all triangulations.
So you prep that, but if you go to some finite order,
mm-hmm. then if it goes to some finite order, then it's solved to some order, right? Then we have higher returns that remain, but they're be small if we said had some small coupling, some small lambda.
Right. So if you just took the term for fixed m, it's not anything.
Hmm?
If you just took the term for the transition amplitude, the physical transition mm-hmm. for a fixed m, which mm-hmm. is analogous to a fixed translation,
right.
and just sum over the labels on mm-hmm.
Right, that doesn't solve anything.
So there's no support for somebody whose point of view is that you can just over triangulation.
Right. There's no support for saying we can just take one. So really it's the interaction between these different...
Even if you took M to infinity, it still doesn't solve.
Right. And I've looked a bit at finding different expressions, so maybe if there is a way of doing this such that you have a refinement instead of a sum of all triangulations, but I haven't seen one yet. So exactly trying to see how many ways there are doing this. Yeah.
Other questions?
Okay.